Today on the Vergecast, James Vincent and Richard Lawler join us. We get into the GPT-3 chatbot saga, Apple's new security features, and the FTC is coming after Microsoft for buying Activision. All coming up right after this. Support for the Vergecast comes from Wix Studio. Wix Studio is an end-to-end web platform that gives agencies and enterprises the total creative freedom to design, develop, and deliver the way they want, and do it all with maximum efficiency. And the feeling you get from creative freedom isn't something money can buy. If you want creative reign in your next project, Wix Studio wants to give you the freedom and tools to do just that. Check it out for yourself.
Hi, we're Visible, the wireless company with nothing to hide. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not into you. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Hello and welcome to the Vergecast, the flagship podcast of The Verge, where we talk about absolutely nothing and waste your time. Now, the robot put an exclamation point at the end of that sentence. Because you see, I asked ChatGPT-3 to write the intro of the show.
You're exuberant.
And I said, write the intro of the show. And it said, and ChatGPT-3 said to me, hello and welcome to the Vergecast, the flagship podcast of The Verge.
That's wrong.
It's lazy.
Yeah.
And so I told the robot to make it funnier, and then it said, hello and welcome to the Vergecast, where we talk about absolutely nothing and waste your time, which is the robot fully telling me to go F myself.
I was like, David would do the exact same if he was here.
We basically replaced David.
Yeah. Done.
See you later, buddy. Anyway, this is the Vergecast. That was the first and last time we're ever going to let a chatbot write the intro. I'm your friend, Neil. Alex Kranz is here.
I'm your friend who doesn't believe in AI.
Oh, you will by the end of this episode. Oh. Richard Lawler is here. Hey, Richard.
Hey, I might be an AI.
That's by the end of this episode. We're gonna have to take bets. And our senior Verge reporter covering AI, James Vincent, is here. Hey, James.
Hey, I am pro AI. I'm pro worshipping AI and just getting ahead of that. And you know that religion that Lewandowski tried to found, I am the guy who carried that on. So
you still got it.
You still got it.
I'm keeping the faith.
Do you have a blue cube in your house with little electric bolts like floating around in it? You know, like one of those like AI monuments.
Neil, do I have a God cube that I worship daily? Jeez, man, that is a very insulting question to ask someone of my faith. I'm going to go if that's going to be the tenor of the conversation, obviously.
So, fair warning, it is, I believe, 9 p.m. for James in the UK, and he's just
drinking.
I'm a
little loose.
The man's just drinking, which honestly, it's only 4 p.m. here in New York.
Yeah, we could do that.
We could be drinking.
Next week.
You should.
It's that kind of week, so we got to talk about ChatGPT with James. The FTC sued Microsoft to block the Activision deal. The EU did some iPhone charging standard stuff. Elon continues to Elon. There's a bunch of stuff to talk about this week. But we have to start with ChatGPT-3, which has taken the world by storm. Mm. If you don't know what it is just a chat bot.
Yeah.
It just happens to be very good.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, I mean, I think it's super fun to play with, but the overheated...
There's some feelings.
People
got
positive
feelings.
And negative. Like, yeah. All the way from VC saying this will replace Google to like fan fiction communities being like, once again, our art has been plundered by the godless heathens of Silicon Valley and we should shut down. You pick either one of those.
It's just the whole gamut. It's the whole gamut of feelings.
So there's a lot of like Verge-y stuff in here. First, we should talk about the technology itself, which is super fascinating. We should talk about OpenAI, the company/research foundation that has made it and published it. And we should talk about all those downstream effects, the angry artists of the world. We should talk about Lenza in this conversation too, the app that makes profile pictures people are all worked up about. Well, let's just start with what it is. James, what is exactly going on with ChatGPT-3?
So it is just ChatGPT rather than ChatGPT-3.
No, it's GPT-3.5 is the thing inside of it.
So yeah, it is ChatGPT, which is a fine-tuned version of an AI bot called ChatGPT 3.5, which is itself is a version, a sort of an upgrade of chat of GPT-3, which is from 2020. So the, sort of the foundation of this tech has been around for a while. And what OpenAI, the company behind this, decided to do is they fine-tuned the bot on conversational dialogue, and they fed it a bunch of sort of conversational prompts, and they got humans to rank the sort of attractiveness, the responsiveness of those prompts. They fed that back into it, and it created a new sort of dialogue mode. And then they took that and they put it into a web demo. And that has been like the huge thing. You know, the baseline technology behind this has sort of been around for a while. It's never been as publicly accessible as this before. And that obviously has created this huge reaction where A, people are seeing what this thing can do for the first time. And B, they're finding new things to do with it. Because, you know, you can get a bunch of AI researchers to play around with a model in a lab. They are never going to be as creative or as chaotic as the internet en masse, suddenly being like, hey, let's talk to this thing and see what it can do. I've got some real interesting questions. So that has created this explosion where suddenly this thing is everywhere. And I'm with you. I do find it quite exciting. Like, there's lots of caveats that need addressing when we talk about this technology. But the base feeling for me is like, oh man, this is pretty cool. Like, we couldn't do this before. It is doing interesting stuff. I'm into it. Let's see where it goes.
Yeah, that to me is the vergiest part of this whole story is what you just described. This underlying technology has been around since 2020. And we have seen very public demos of similar technology. Like at Google I.O., Sundar Pichai has demonstrated Google's riff on large language models like this. And you can go back and watch them. They're very funny. He's like, I'm going to have a conversation with the planet now. Yeah. And then for a few minutes, we all just sit there while Sundar's like, what's it like to be Pluto? And a robot is like, it's weird. And everyone's like, what is the purpose of this? But that is the same LLM idea, right? Where you feed an AI a massive amount of language data, a massive corpus of text, and it learns how to talk to you.
Yeah.
OpenAI has a different riff, which GPT we've seen. But that, like, Google's been doing that demo for a while. Yeah. Then on top of that, we've already experienced like three or four news cycles of serious, meaningful controversy around LLMs. In particular, again, at Google with Timnit Gebru. And then there was just the researcher who claimed it was sentient and it was fired for warning Google that their LLM was sentient. The Timnit Gebru is much more, I think, important, less funny, but more important, where she was like, I'm publishing papers about the ethics of AI like this. And she claims Google fired her for publishing those papers. This is like a big deal.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is we have gone through the gamut with the underlying technology. We've seen the big hypey demos. We've seen the ethics controversy. We've seen the engineer who claims it's alive get fired. Like, there's a lot of peaks and valleys to the story already over the past few years. And what has happened now is that the user interface got good.
Yeah.
Right. The user interface to do this before, right? You had to install a bunch of stuff on your computer, or like, you just had to like work hard to get to the place where you could type in a prompt.
Yeah.
Now it's very much you can just talk to it.
Yeah. You log in and you start chatting.
Yeah. I mean, it is actually like that is a remarkable advancement in its own way.
Yeah.
But the underlying tech is not that different than what it was before, is it?
No. And I think actually even the UI, the making it conversational, is something that we've been able to do for a while. And I think actually the sort of the thing that has happened is that AI companies have got a little less scared this year. And that there has been some successes with text-to-image models, specifically Stable Diffusion, who disrupted, you know, the status quo within this industry. So you had all these image models like DALL-E, which were relatively restricted. Stable Diffusion is open source. Anyone can build on it. Anyone can mess around with it. That will have bad consequences, but it's also created a lot of interest and excitement, and people have built on it. And I think that gave AI companies some new confidence. I remember speaking earlier this year to Meta about a chatbot that they put out. And one of the things that one of their execs said to me was like, it's not 2016 anymore. When the Microsoft Tay chatbot went online, became a racist asshole in 24 hours and then got pulled off. You know, they were saying like, yes, that was bad, but A, we've got more guardrails than we used to. And B, we're kind of thinking that this is the best way we advance this stuff. So I think there has been a period of timidity, which in many ways is connected to the criticisms that came out of Google with the Stochastic Parrots paper, which was the one by Timnit Gebru and a few others, Margaret Mitchell, which is, you know, incredibly valuable, important stuff. They brought up these issues and they are huge, real issues. But I think that made the company sort of stutter for a while. And in 2022, OpenAI particularly has been like, you know what? F it. We're just going to put it out there and see what happens. And people in OpenAI will be congratulating themselves for this, I'm sure, because they have got so much attention. They've got so much goodwill out of it. They're burning money doing it. But, you know, it really has moved the conversation forward for better or worse.
Can you, before we move on, can you quickly just tell people what a stochastic parrot is and what this paper said? Because I think it underlies the whole controversy.
Oh, yeah.
To understand this technology, you have to understand that criticism.
So there are a lot of points that are made within the paper. But I think the big thing about it is, what is a stochastic parrot? It is a probabilistic machine. Right. And this is the big thing. In many ways, it's the big thing about the deep learning revolution in general, in that instead of creating a deterministic computer where X does Y does Z does, you know, ABC, knocks on like that, you take a machine that looks at data, that looks for patterns in that data, learns to replicate that data, and then deals probabilities out to you. And that probabilistic nature of AI and of large language models in particular creates all sorts of downstream problems, often to do with the data that these systems are trained on. Stochastic parrots had a lot of criticisms about, you know, a lot of problems. I don't want to frame these people as critics, because I feel that in a way diminishes what they're saying, because then you get the critics and the proponents and you're either for or against the technology. These aren't people who are against the technology. They're just people who have things to say about it and, you know, correct observations to make. But so when you have a probabilistic model, when you say train it on data scraped from the internet, that is going to return all the bad things in that data. And that is stuff like biases. That is, you know, bias against people of color, against women. It has stereotypes within that. And we know that these models, including ChatGPT, these problems are not fixed. They are still replicating these bias issues. So yeah, that's one thing within the paper, but there are others, but I'll leave it at that.
Well, so and this gets to very much how it works, which we should also just touch on briefly. We're calling it an AI.
Yeah.
And it's made by a company called OpenAI.
But it's not an AI.
But it's not actually an AI. And this chat client, its main feature is that it appears to have a sense of state.
Yeah.
Right? You ask it a question, it gives you an answer. You ask it a follow-up, it appears to remember what has transpired and answer a follow-up question. That is also a mirage. So can talk about how it works, and, you know, it's sort of just like guessing the next word of a sentence. And then we should talk about how it's preserving the sense of state to create the impression of a conversation.
Yeah. I mean, so at the basis, a language model, particularly GPT-3, is an autocomplete, right? It has looked at this data, it has looked and it is mapped out in these incredible multidimensional graphs, the proximity of words to one another, essentially. And by doing that, when it looks at how often words appear next to each other, you get this semantic map, which allows you to know that, you know, king is like queen because they're part of this body called monarchy. But king also has this connection with man, while queen has a connection with woman. And, it maps out all this semantic data. And then essentially you feed it a string of words and then it will predict what will come next. What happens when you turn that into a conversation is that there is a lot of clever behind the scenes stuff, which honestly, I don't quite understand. I don't understand the basic mechanisms of it, but it essentially, you know, it turns your question into a prompt in which it tries to predict based on what you've asked it, what the answer would or should or could be. Yeah. So that is the sort of the underlying mechanism there. What you've pointed out, the fact that these systems, particularly ChatGPT, have a sense of state, I think that really changes how you interact with them, as you rightly point out, you know, because you start thinking of it as an entity, not as a sort of a a function where you ask it discrete questions and it gives you discrete answers. And I think this sense of state is what led to the Google engineer, Blake Lemoine, you know, mistaking this thing for a conscious being of some sort. So a state is very important. It helps the user, right? But it also creates this false sense of personhood. And I think that is going to be a really tricky balance in the future with these models, knowing how to split that divide.
I mean, how different is it from Siri or Alexa or something like that? Because I have to admit, the few times I've used ChatGPT, it hasn't worked for me. It gave me this whole, I asked it for a story,
right,
and it gave me an entire story. And it was like, and then they killed the dragon, and then they fought Thanos.
Right.
And I was like, is Thanos the dragon? And it was like, I don't know how to respond to that question. And I was like, but
oh no,
you just told me all about it. So it felt like, for me so far, my experience with it has been very Alexa, very, very Siri, which is why I'm like, it seems fine, and I haven't been super impressed. But it sounds like you guys have all had, like, much different.
Well, so I'll tell you, even this little joke about complete the sentence, welcome to the Vergecast, that query I had to enter specifically that way.
Yeah.
When I said, what is the Vergecast the flagship podcast of? I got a stock answer that says, I cannot search the internet for you.
Right.
Right, and so there are these, like, dead ends, and it's like, I don't – that's a weird –
Yeah, it's kind of like early days of Google where you, like, you had to really think about how you worded that question. Yeah. And I know, James, you were talking – you recently wrote a piece where you had a friend who, like, used it to create a whole new macro.
Yeah, an Excel macro. Just, you know, he's a guy who works in higher education. He does a lot of database wrangling as part of his job, but he's not a coder. He's never had a formal training that. He studied English at university, you know, and he was just casually saying, I asked it for an Excel macro about how to, you know, extract this sort of selection of dates, and it came up with it, and he got it to work in a matter of minutes. And I just thought, well, that really says something about the accessibility of these systems.
Yeah.
There's a piece of the puzzle there that is really important, right? Because the most impressive examples I've seen of the system working are people asking it to write computer programs,
right?
Write me code, which we think of as a very difficult thing to do. I'm sure all the people who actually write code for a living listening to this are like, that's not so hard. But like the relationship between human language and computer language is usually mediated by people, mostly mediated by people. And having a robot that can make that connection for you and take your English language query and spit out workable code in the language of your choice. The most impressive ones I've seen have all been in C#, which is like a weird Microsoft corner case language, right? Like that's amazing to me. And it's because the corpus of text on the internet includes so much code.
Exactly. Yeah.
And to me is like a fascinating reflection of what you're talking about, which is the inputs reflect the outputs.
Yeah.
It can do this because there is so much code on the internet.
Yeah.
If you were to ask it to do other kinds of things that the internet is not so good at.
Like recipes. Quick, somebody ask it to make a cookie. Give me a cookie recipe.
Apparently it's quite good at recipes.
There's a lot of recipe text on the internet.
Yeah
but they usually have the opener where the person has to talk about how the cookies remind them of their grandmother's house.
Well, so this is like you get all the way downstream of it to, well, this is like why people think it's going to replace Google.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is asking this thing questions returns more interesting answers that are more conversational and are often just the answer. Mm. Write me an Excel macro. If you wrote that into Google, you would be flooded with a list of garbage.
Yeah.
Like Google would basically return to you nothing of value.
Bunch of paywalls.
A bunch of paywalls, a bunch of SEO spam text, a bunch of articles Quora. That were like slideshows.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, this actually is not a date sort in Excel.
Yeah.
This is just, you're trying to get
bunch
me to
buy a
bunch
of YouTube results. It's like, actually, you should just watch this 20-minute video. We got you.
And there's a reason that other search products like Stack Overflow and Yelp and all these other things exist. They're more targeted search interfaces to certain kinds of results. And they have built businesses not being gamed by Google in that way. ChatGPT is like you ask a question. It just tells you an answer with utter confidence. It's like, here is some code you can type into your computer to do a date sort. And like, maybe it's pure malware. Like, maybe you're going to hack like an Iranian nuclear reactor. Like, you have no idea what's going to happen, but it's like, here it is.
Yeah. You got it.
Like, here's a recipe for a whiskey sour. One cup bleach, please. And it just like, no, like absolutely no hesitation whatsoever. And I think that is why people are reacting to it.
Yeah.
Because there's no business model between you and something that is presented to you confidently, like an answer, even if the answer is garbage.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and it's,
there's no business model yet.
Right. Right now it's burning money. James, how much money does this thing cost to run? Because it seems like they're just lighting VC dollars on fire.
Well, I think, Alex, you didn't you do something on this? I remember, I can't remember the figures.
Yeah, a guy did the math on it. And basically each query costs like 0.0003 cents. And right. So it's costing them about $3 million a day on average with like, They assumed the number of people using it and the number of queries and stuff, but probably about $3 million on average. And that was based on the pricing for AWS, which is where this is all running out of, because it has to use a lot of GPUs to do all of this. Like one, I think they said like one GPU would maybe present one word in a couple of minutes. So it's having to use like a ton of processing power, probably way more than Google does for Google search.
Which explains a lot about Google search.
Yeah. Yeah. Use more GPUs.
Yeah.
Well, so that to me is really fascinating, right? So as Richard's pointing out, it doesn't make money yet. The costs are high.
Yeah.
On a long enough timeline, the costs of technology come down, sure. But right now the costs are high. And they're going to have to somehow make this a product.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're seeing that with Linza, right? Like Linza is this other big AI thing that's using, I think, open source engine.
Yeah, it's using Stable Diffusion, which is an open source text-to-image AI, but also is monetized by the company that funds it. And I say funds it rather than made it, because there is a very convoluted sort of licensing scheme going on that the company that is associated with it, Stability AI, has put in place in order to avoid future legal liability. So they fund it, but they don't research it and they don't make it technically.
Right.
But anyway, yeah.
And so this other company, Prism, is that the name of it?
Prisma Labs, yeah.
Prisma Labs has taken this engine and they've put it into their app. And so if you pay a certain amount of money, you can have little cute digital portraits of yourself. Yeah. And also help them continue to train this AI. Basically, effectively, you're paying them to train their AI.
Well, whether they keep the AI, yeah. do they keep the data for training AI? I feel like this is such a meme within within Twitter that like, oh, tool X is keeping your data for Y. And yeah.
That's happened in the past. Like we have seen that happen before, but, where a company is like, yeah, give us your face. Oh, by the way, we're working on facial recognition.
Yeah, Facetune. Yeah, I think it was Facetune.
Yeah. Definitely seen that. And Prisma Labs, to their credit, has said, they told TechCrunch earlier this week, either this week or last week.
Yeah.
Anyway, to their credit, Prisma Labs did tell TechCrunch that they aren't keeping a lot of this data. They are deleting it. It's going away from their servers. But isn't it still training Stable Diffusion? Or are they just like...
It wouldn't be training Stable Diffusion. Stable Diffusion would be sort of separate from that. And Stable Diffusion is based on a big database called Lion, which again is made by a German university. I guess they could be keeping it. I don't know. My feeling on that is that the bad PR of finding out an app is keeping your data in order to train its systems would outweigh the cheapness of just buying that data. You know, if you want to get a million faces downloaded to train a facial recognition system, there exists a database called Megaface.
You sound like a character from Cyberpunk. You want to get a million faces.
Do you want a million faces, my friend?
If you want to get a million faces, I can get you a million faces.
I got several million faces back here. You take a look. I got what you need. Come
on. Do all this work to get faces. I get your faces.
Oh, I got your faces, guy. Come on.
Yeah. Prisma Lab, they found their other ways. I mean, even if they aren't doing the whole, we're going to steal all of your facial recognition data so that we can sell it somewhere else, they are saying you have to sign up for a month of our service.
Right, but that's just like Apple App Store. This is what I mean. Like once traditional you add the app business store model to it, which is like, we don't want to sell you an app. We don't want to sell you one in-app purchase. We want to make you subscribe to our app and then forget that you're subscribed to our app.
Yes.
So we get at least one more month of money from you.
They're going to make so much money next month.
I think this will be gone pretty soon. This specific iteration of it. Does anyone remember Style Transfer? Like, that was like a big AI sort of trend in like 2015, 2016, I want to say. And you know what? Prisma Labs did that. They did that back in the day. I was looking up some old articles I wrote about them because the name was familiar to me. And they used to do these style transfer things where you'd put in a picture and it would make it look like Van Gogh, or it would make it look like stained glass. And, you know, this was a thing for a while. Facebook did it. You'd see it on people's profile pictures and it was gone within a month.
Yeah.
And now it's an Adobe feature.
Yeah, it's an Adobe feature and it's a boring preset thing. And I think AI portraits will probably go that way pretty quickly, but something next will come.
But there's something underlying all of this, which is kind of the cultural controversy of it, right? So we've talked about where it came from, how it works, the controversy. That importantly, I think the democratization of the technology with easier to use user interfaces. And in the case of Lensa, right, Stable Diffusion is a thing that you can today download it and run it on your computer.
Yeah.
You can just do it if you want. It's hard. Like, yeah. People don't want to do it. Actually, Apple just released an update that makes Stable Diffusion run faster on its phones.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, which is big. Yeah.
Right. And it's like a 40% performance boost on the neural engine on like an M2. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, this is, it's all happening, but it's, here's an app where you can pay $4 to get some profile pictures.
It's
actually a much more like democratic. Yeah. Anybody can use it. That's when I say, like, that's the vergiest part of this story. It's like, you give all the people the tools and then you have no idea what's going to happen. And that's like, that's when I just like am the happiest.
What's that called again, James? When
chaos?
You give people all the...
Sorry,
what? You had, like, you had a specific word for it in the piece you wrote today about AI.
Oh, the overhang.
The overhang.
Yeah, so that's not necessarily about accessibility. The phrase is capability overhang, which I love it. It sounds like, I don't know, it sounds like a minor character in a Pynchon novel. capability overhang. But it essentially refers to the hidden capabilities of AI systems that it's sort of something that AI researchers get quite excited about and stay up late talking about when they think about the fact that these models do things that we don't even know that we don't know that they do, right? That there are unknown unknowns about what these things can do. And the point I made in my piece was that although there exists a capability overhang within the research community, there also exists one within the sort of public awareness of this. And 2022, particularly the last couple of months, when we've seen tools like ChatGPT, we've seen, I mean, remember like Crayon, the AI image generator that was everywhere for a little bit and is now already just sort of like part of the background tapestry of the internet?
Yeah, we forgot.
These tools. Yeah, we've forgotten. But these tools are just becoming part of everyday life now. And we are now climbing that overhang, the public. We're discovering what these capabilities are. And I think 2023 is going to be wild for this stuff. And we're going to see a lot of consequences happen as well.
That's where we should kind of wrap this up with. Because to me, the image-based AI, in some way, that stuff is harder for a regular person to do, right? Mm. A really good example is, you know, Casey Newton used to work at The Verge, and we would illustrate his newsletter with actual designers and illustrators. Like, a human being who worked here, most recently Alex Castro, who's a great illustrator, would, like, illustrate Casey's newsletter once a week.
Right.
Yeah.
Casey now routinely has DALL-E illustrate the newsletter, right? He, like, types a prompt into an image generator and, like, whatever, it's done. And there was a moment where that, you know, all the arguments about – there was even, like, a minor controversy about news publications using these tools for illustrations instead of hiring illustrators. But that stuff seems faddish, even though it's harder, right? Even though most people cannot illustrate anything on their own. That stuff, stylistically, it comes and goes. The usages for those things, like images, expire in a way that, you know, like other kinds of formats don't. It's the text side. It's the, you wrote me some code, or I've seen the number of advertising people I have seen who are like, we're going to spam the most marketing text on the most content marketing blogs that you have ever seen. This is a godsend for the agencies. And it's like, first of all of you talk about advertising is though you're like boning. Like, there's like, if you just like are in that world, it's like, you gotta be less horny about ads. Like, that's my advice to all of you.
10% at least.
Just like 10% less horny about advertising, please. And then there is like, oh, that's real. right? Like if you run a small ad agency and you're like hired to sell bottles of water and you need to make the website that's about how great the bottled water is.
Nobody's reading it anyway.
Right. You're kind of like, what I need is a bunch of keywords for Google.
Yeah.
So when people Google bottled water, they like, Google's like, well, I found this site with a lot of bottled water references on it.
I do wonder if it's going
to
like.
They're definitely not going to hire some like 22-year-old kid to do it. They're going to be like, robot, write me bottled water copy.
Write me my SEO copy.
And they're going to like edit it a little bit and they're going to put it on their website. And they're already, they see it. They see the value of that completely.
Yeah. I wonder if that's actually bigger danger to Google.
I will give a little hint about an episode of Decoder that we have on our minds. There's a very famous hustle culture gentleman. Out in the world.
Yeah.
I love him. I've been wanting this gentleman on Decoder for a long time. So I've been following him and I got recommended a bunch of his staffers. And one of his staffers has a TikTok. It's like, you know, sometimes you need to write 45 tweets for a campaign. Have you met ChatGPT?
Yeah.
And he's like, here's 45 tweets that I wrote for this campaign for like our hustle culture product. And it's like, oh, that shit's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that to me is more durable, more interesting, more chaotic, more impactful than the image stuff. And I think the image stuff gets all the press because most people can't make images.
Right.
Obviously, most people can make text. But the part where it's – and maybe I'm biased because I make text for a living. And I also apparently talk about nothing on this podcast. but the part where it's like, oh, like most of the text on the internet is like, so Google will find it. And so now we're going to trick the Google robot with our robot.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we're in the end times. I love it here.
Well, it feels like, I mean, that's what I was like, I think that's where Google has to face the threat. It's not, oh, I can go and chat with this thing and it'll give me results. It's, oh, other people can go chat with it and it will give them results, thus making Google SEO even more worthless.
So, James, you have written about Google exploring these models for search. Mm. And I feel like the biggest meme of the past week is this is going to replace Google. And you actually wrote, we republished, re-promoted a piece that you wrote a year ago about Google exploring this exact idea and kind of walking away from it.
Well, I mean, I don't think they walked away from it forever because as you have pointed out, they love to demo this stuff, like the conversations with Mum and Lambda, which are two of their big large language models, which are sort of their equivalents of GPT-3. But they did write this paper in May or June 2021, I can't remember exactly, where they pointed out a lot of the problems with it. And in my piece, I sort of thought that actually it's problems they faced before. The big one is the confidence in presenting what is potentially false information. Large language models, because of their stochastic, their probabilistic nature, they cannot sort fact from fiction reliably. There are probably ways around that. There's ways to build in, I'm sure, a directory of knowledge that it checks against, that it looks for citations with. But there is this problem with confidence. And we saw it actually, I thought, with Google Home, where you used to ask Google a question and it was not a Google search, of course. It would just give you the answer. And that UI, that presentation is to me the same as ChatGPT because there is confidence, there is no outside sources, and there is often a chance that you'll give entirely the wrong response. And it is something that happens a lot. I think these are fixable problems. I think the question is, does a startup come up with a better search engine, which is probably really janky and probably actually causes a lot of trouble? Do they get that out there before Google itself puts out a version which preserves its credibility? The thing is, Google has much more to lose in this scenario, whereas a startup can burn a lot of, like, it can create a lot of goodwill and it can say, we're doing something fast, we're going to the moon with this, and it can put out something that is potentially very dangerous and get away with it and maybe scoop Google. I think these things will, there are problems with them, but I think they will be incorporated into search in the next couple of years. And the question for me is whether, who gets that first, basically.
What do you think the most interesting use of the technology as it exists today is?
Just creating psychosis in its users. I think if you talk to these things for long enough, you will go mad. There is a reason that guy, that Google engineer, was like, you know what? It's alive. There's a reason we started the show by joking about an AI religion. One of my favorite books of the last couple of years, and I don't know why I'm doing this. Is this a podcast? Anyway,
he's holding up a book. This is great.
I'm holding up a book. It is called Pharmaco AI, and it's by an artist, a writer, Kay Alardo McDowell. And it is an extended conversation with GPT-3 in which Alardo McDowell sort of reimagines GPT-3 as this godhead, as this sort of mythical divine entity that drives them mad, basically, over the course of the book, in my opinion. And I think the weirdest and the most wonderful thing is the conversations we're going to have with what is essentially a really weird mirror of ourselves. You know, for better or worse, these things are scraped from the internet and we can influence them with our feedback. That means they are like us. It is something that reflects us back to us. And I think that is going to create some really, really strange cultural experiences for everyone.
There's another version of GPT-3 coming out, right? GPT-4 is apparently on the horizon.
Oh, yeah. It's on the horizon.
What happens with it? What is
James
the improvement?
James is so excited. Just
I'm sorry. I did that again.
It was great. Yeah,
he did the Mr. Burns with his fingers.
That was completely instinctive. I'm so embarrassed by that. I don't know why I did that.
What's exciting? Why are you doing this?
Well, it's
well, finally
bigger.
Humankind will block out the sun.
Yeah.
Don't get shot by a baby.
Look, finally, I can get it. I can get an AI to do my job, finally. And I can just get drunk on podcasts instead. It's all I've been out trying to do. No, I don't know. I'm excited because I think hopefully it will be as much as a leap forward as GPT-3 was from GPT-2, which I used both programs. I play around with them. And it was quite a step forward, actually. We don't know when it's going to come out. There were rumors that it would be the end of this year. It's now looking like it will be early next year. And actually, a lot of the rumors were basically about ChatGPT. But it's supposed to be much, much bigger, you know, in terms of the parameters, which is the sort of metric by which you measure the size of these and the complexity of these models. Actually, no one knows anything about it. Apart from that, there is just a lot of sort of like funny rumors going around that, you know, GPT-4 is, you know, the computational matrix is equal to the complexity of all organic life on Earth, which I believe is Douglas Adams. You know, it's that sort of joke, basically. But yeah, that should be early next year. And I'm with Neil. I think this is going to have like a huge influence on jobs. I think this is actually we're going to start seeing industries change because of this technology very soon.
You know, we need to wrap this up. But what's fundamentally interesting about that is, I think in a popular imagination, the automation has always replaced the blue collar jobs. Mm-hmm. Mm. And to some extent that is true. And we're going to talk about the TSMC factory that got opened in Arizona this week. Like, yes, there's a bunch of cars are built by robot arms now.
Yeah.
But it turns out the AI is just like, it's coming for ad agencies, right? Just like the way that Excel came for accounting firms.
Yeah.
And I don't think that anybody has quite yet reckoned for that. The AI is coming for mid-level Excel macro coders more than it is coming for factory workers, right? Because if you can just ask a robot to be like, sort some dates and it spits out the code at you, there's actually just a kind of like a huge middle class of white collar work that goes away. And no one can check the AI's work because it's so confident.
Well, and it's going to create work too, right? Like all of these, every time you do these queries and stuff, somebody somewhere is probably having to comb through some of them and check them and make sure that things are getting labeled properly and that everything's working. Because this is
that's
a
what
lot
you want.
Of
you want to be the AI, the semantic AI data checker.
I think that is
that's a
sci-fi
novel.
Job.
That's a job of the future where you just go through and you check the tags on the ChatGPT app.
Yep, this person's talking about porn with GPT, and I'm here with them.
I mean, have you guys answered any CAPTCHA lately? This is already part of our day-to-day lives.
Yeah, that's true. We've been doing it for a long time. This is a fire hydrant. So we should let you go, yes. James. We should call out. James has his own very good book called Beyond Measure, which is a delight.
Oh,
soon
you.
To be excerpted in The Verge when it comes out in the United States. Tell us about your book, James.
Oh, it is a history of measurement. It is a sort of, you know, it's a history, it's a science book, it's a sociology book. It's where do measurements come from? What do people do with them? And why do Americans hate the metric system so much? Those are the three big questions I tackle.
It's very good. It's very funny. I have a British copy because I'm fancy.
Oh, do you?
I bought it early.
I see.
I bought an import.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
I used to do a 7 inches. I bought an import copy. You know, the U.S. version has a bonus edition of Train in Vain at the very end. It's not labeled. All right, we've gone on too long. James, thank you so much. Always a pleasure, man.
Oh, my pleasure. So nice to step in. And speak to you guys later. Bye-bye.
All right, we'll be right back. We got to talk about Apple, Elon. There's all kinds of stuff. We'll be right back.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte.
Here's the story of innovation told in 5 words. Try. Explore. Connect. Pivot. Transform. See what happened there? As soon as Connect entered the story, innovation became achievable. That's why Deloitte works with clients and tech alliances to bring together the people, ideas, and technologies to overcome, solve, and of course, transform. Connect to what matters for innovation. Start at Deloitte.com/US/innovate.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
All right, we're back.
Yeah, we're back. You know, Neelai, so we're here in the office, Neelai and I are, and I saw him hunched over his desk earlier today, just muttering FTC and Activision Blizzard. It sounds like there's some stuff happening with the Microsoft Activision Blizzard deal.
Yeah, it's like the least breaking news of all time. I don't know how else to describe it. So the FTC filed a lawsuit.
Right.
There's some details about it that we should talk about. But Microsoft wants to buy Activision Blizzard.
They've wanted to for a while.
ActiBlizz.
ActiBlizz.
Which makes Call of Duty.
Yeah. They said, we're not going to touch it. We're just going to let it do its thing. We promise
we'll talk about Call of Duty in a second. So they make Call of Duty. They make Candy Crush. They make all – Activision Blizzard makes all the money on Candy Crush, by the way. Phil Spencer was just on Decoder talk about why the deal wasn't anti-competitive.
Why it was so good. And
even though Microsoft keeps buying every studio. Like this is their third gigantic studio.
Right.
And they obviously make a bunch of other stuff. And so there's all this back and forth specifically around Call of Duty.
Yes.
Right? Sony is like, you're going to take Call of Duty away from the PlayStation. Gamers rise up. The gamers rose up. Microsoft is like, no. Phil Spencer, to me, has said many times, we're going to put Call of Duty on PlayStation as long as there's a Call of Duty. Then there was this like sidelight conspiracy theory, which was honestly my favorite conspiracy theory, that they would only do Call of Duty on PlayStation as like an Xbox Game Pass streaming situation.
I love it.
So Sony would be forced to Trojan horse the Game Pass streaming app on the PlayStation
so
you could stream Call of Duty. So I asked about that. He got all riled up. He was like, no, native code. And I was like, how long is the deal? Initially, they'd only offered 3 years. And Phil told me, like, you can't write a contract forever, which is true.
Right.
Like, this is not legal advice. This is not a legal show. If you're listening to the show without your lawyer, you're making a mistake. please drive immediately to the nearest lawyer's office to continue listening to the show.
I'll just ask ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should you sign a contract whose term is forever? And I feel like very clearly the answer is no.
Even ChatGPT will be like, don't do that.
Don't do that. Like, no contracts are forever. So fine, I get it. So then Microsoft has been running around these past few weeks trying to appease regulators in this country and in Europe by saying, okay, we will commit to Call of Duty for 10 years.
Okay.
Which is an awful long time.
Yeah.
Like they're going to be out of major world conflicts to mine and they will be fully in the future.
They're already in the future. No, they're
going to have to get rid of like all the World War II Call of Duties are done for.
Yeah, they're done.
They went to the future and they went back already.
Like Call of Duty is like, they're just going to be out of wars or like whatever. AI Call of Duty is where we're at. 10 years now. That was not good enough. It was not good enough for the CMA in Europe, which has already said we're going to stop it. We're starting an investigation. And then here, the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, has basically been rumbling at this for a long time.
Yeah, just muttering to itself.
Just like, we're not going to let this happen. So when I say there's some like, there's a little bit of interest.
Yeah.
They filed the suit, the lawsuit. Okay. We have not seen the complaint yet. The word on the street is they're not going to release it until Microsoft has like gotten it. Until Microsoft President Brad Smith is like, sat down with a snifter of brandy and like read the complaint.
Put his little smoking jacket on.
But today, the day they said they're going to do this complaint. Oh, they also filed the complaint in their own administrative court, not in federal court.
Okay.
Which is like tactically interesting. Like, what do they actually want out of this? Do they actually want to block the deal, or is just a lot of bluster to get some concession? Who knows? But today, the same day, is the first day of the trial where the FTC has sued to stop Meta, Facebook, from buying Within, which makes Supernatural, which I have called the killer app for VR.
It's pretty killer.
It's very good. So if you have a Quest 2, Supernatural is a fitness app. You like.
It's Beat Saber, but you have to like sweat.
It's Beat Saber Peloton. Yeah. Oh, they've added kicking.
They added kicking?
Yeah, knee strikes.
All right. Well,
and
I
there's
got.
There's also boxing.
I got some. The boxing is great. Boxing's like the boxing.
I think I've told the story in the Verge House before. My wife did the boxing in Supernatural one time, grinned the whole time, then took off the headset and said, I'm great at boxing. Like, that's what you want, right? So this thing's great. It sells a lot of headsets. Chris Milk, the CEO of Within, has been on Decoder. He's like, the Supernatural community is like 50-50 men and women, and it's people over 40, which is not a traditional VR user base. Like, this is the thing. This app initiates people into buying the Quest 2 because it's good. So Meta said, screw it. We buy every other VR game. We're going to buy Supernatural. They went and bought it. FTC sued them. This deal is like teeny tiny. They're buying this thing for like $20.
Yeah.
And it's an app for VR headsets.
Yeah.
A market size of 6. Like, they're the biggest fish in a tiny, tiny, tiny pond. If the FTC is going to block that deal, they basically had no choice.
But to block.
To block the Activision deal. It's like, right, obviously, console gaming is much bigger. Activision itself is much bigger. Microsoft very opportunistically swept in because Bobby Kotick to Activision is like.
I mean, Activision Blizzard has been facing some bad times for the last.
Like numerous allegations of like weird sexual misconduct across the company.
Yep. A lot of people have been let go for misconduct. There's a lot of union organizing happening because of the misconduct.
Yeah.
I would not want to work there right now. It seems really busy.
Yeah.
Seems unpleasant.
And so Microsoft very openly, like after this first wave of allegations, they just like showed up and they're like, wouldn't it be great if you didn't run this company anymore?
Yeah, just give it to us.
Give it to us. And so like there's just a lot of noise. So if you're going to, if you are the FTC and you have to, and you have sued to block Meta from buying Supernatural. And by the way, that complaint, you know, I'm anti, I think mergers are bad, but the FTC's complaint in that is like, we've tried Supernatural. It's a very good. Like, you shouldn't have it, right? If you buy Supernatural, you will not turn Beat Saber into a proper competitor for Supernatural. And I think rightfully, Meta, the Beat Saber team, were like, what are you talking about? Like, in what world is Beat Saber turning into a Peloton?
Yeah.
Like, no, that's like, what?
In the world of the FTC where they want
they have to find some reason. So they filed this. We have not read it. They filed it in this administrative court. They have said to Axios, or someone has said to Axios, they're not asking to actually like block the deal at this time. So the deal might still close. So they've sued to block the deal. So it shouldn't happen. But they've not asked their own administrative court to be like,
yeah,
don't let them do it. So there's a little nuance in there that I, without having read the complaint, I can't quite tell you about, and the complaint's not out yet, but you just get the sense that like the Europeans are definitely on firmer ground when it comes to blocking mergers. That's like what they're good at.
Yeah.
And the FTC is like, we're also finally suing. And maybe what we want is some intensely hardcore concessions. And this is like calibrated to achieve that result while they go fight this other battle around Supernatural. In court, where they, you know, Lena Khan still has to prove her theory.
Because the Supernatural, that's not in the administrative law court.
That's in court.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's other cases against Facebook and others that she has filed. She's the chairwoman of the FTC. She's got novel theories about competition. And I, again, completely honest, like, I agree with most of her theories. The courts in this country are like, that's new. New ideas, you say. No, thank you.
They don't understand what a phone is.
They're deeply confused about how some of this technology works, and in particular, like network effects and like how you might lock people in. So, and we're seeing this with Apple and Epic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just some baseline confusion about what creates lock-in for a consumer,
yeah,
or where anti-competitive in these markets might come from. And then there's the real problem, and this is particularly true in Apple and Epic and some of these other cases, where our country in particular, for about 40 years, has been like, mergers, great.
Love a merger.
Love a merger.
Bigger you want to
buy
the
some
better.
Shit, you should buy some shit.
Yeah.
Right? And so you've got to just overcome a lot of precedent to block a merger. So I just see, like, I see where this case is calibrated, mm-hmm. and I see that the Europeans want to block it too. And we'll just see. I don't know. Do you think it's going to, like, you know, Microsoft is, like, running out there. And again, you should listen to the conversation I had with Phil about it on Decoder. He made his case.
Yeah.
Right? And it's very funny when a big company wants to buy something. The case is always, but we suck.
Yeah, we suck so much. Let us buy this.
This market is so competitive. We've been getting our ass kicked. We're nowhere in mobile games. We need to buy Candy Crush.
Yeah.
Call of Duty, you could have Call of Duty. The future is mobile, right? Like, go listen to it. Phil is very good. The man was born to be the CEO of Microsoft. He's very, very good at that job. And he's a candid executive. So you can go listen to it. But the argument basically boils down to, if we don't grow, we die, and all the growth is in mobile. So we have to buy Activision so we can get mobile games.
Yeah.
And all the stuff we're talking about with our consoles is, like, kind of a sidelight. Do you buy it?
I mean, I don't, because that's not their biggest market, right? Like, Xbox is certainly a big part of Microsoft, but cloud computing is a much bigger part of Microsoft.
Yeah.
And so for them to say this, it's just, like, super disingenuous, because, like, yeah, they're a gaming company, but they're a cloud company first and foremost, even more so than they're an operating system company or any of these other things. Like, they do cloud computing. So to say this is just, like, some bullshit.
I honestly don't know where this is going to go. Like, this is a big case. This is a generationally important antitrust case.
Yeah.
Because we just have not stopped deals like this as a country.
I thought it was kind of interesting that we've seen Microsoft go on this spree around the same time that we also saw, like, one of the biggest kind of halts in vertical integration in the entertainment community go away, which was the Paramount decree that was, like, from the 30s that they got rid of a couple of years ago. And that Paramount decree said, if you are making the movies, you cannot own the theaters, because that's really hinky, because then you get to control where your movies screen.
Yeah.
And the exact, like, we're dealing with that issue in streaming, and we're dealing with it in gaming. If Microsoft is making the game consoles, they probably shouldn't also be making the games, because then they control where those games go. And, like, it's fundamentally the same thing. But I know that our country has said, yeah, consent, Paramount's consent decree, don't need it. We're fine. Yeah.
So to abstract that out, it's usually, like, you know, vertical versus horizontal mergers, right? And so we allow vertical ones, or we have for the past 40 years, which is, the theaters were the only distribution.
Yeah.
And if you own all the distribution, you have a lot of power over the studios. And so the studios shouldn't own the theaters, because then they can unfairly discriminate.
Disney can say, you will never see another MGM movie in our theaters again.
And we own all the theaters. So they're like, no, you can't do that. The theaters have to be competitive. You can, like, apply that lesson to the iOS App Store.
Yeah.
You can apply that lesson to Comcast, like, whatever it is, like, whoever owns the pipes or the distribution. Here, I think you're saying, like, the game consoles they're like the distribution.
Yeah, the game consoles are the theater, right? Like, and they have a very robust big business there. If they're making the theaters, they probably shouldn't also be making the content that goes into those theaters. In this case, all of the games that Activision Blizzard, one of the largest gaming companies not currently owned by Microsoft, or Nintendo, existing.
One thing that makes it a little more complicated is that generally the consoles are sold at a loss. They're not necessarily profiting on the actual consoles themselves.
Because they're profiting on those.
They're making the profit on the games. And I guess Microsoft is claiming that they would love to make more money from games. So, of course, they'll sell Call of Duty on PlayStation or Nintendo or Steam. Because everyone wants to play Call of Duty on Switch. That's what you want.
Yeah.
That's,
by the way, Nintendo happily took the 10-year deal for Call of Duty.
Yeah.
No complaints filed. No letters to the senators. They're like, 10 years of Call of Duty on the Switch? We'll take it, because they don't give a shit.
Did that specify what kind of Call of Duty? Like, is it just going to be the mobile gross version that's on your phone?
I don't think it matters to Nintendo. I think
Nintendo doesn't care.
That anybody who owns a console also probably wants to play Mario.
Yeah.
And they've got an absolute rock solid, legally defensible monopoly on Mario. And he's never going anywhere except Nintendo consoles.
It is very funny that we're like, oh, I don't know if Microsoft can own Call of Duty. And Nintendo is like, we own everything on our platform, and we will destroy.
That's their model. I mean, they're the Apple of this industry, and Microsoft is the Microsoft.
But what I want to know is what kind of concessions could the FTC get? And I'm very specific about my needs. I need to be able to use controllers across platforms. I don't like buying multiple controllers. I don't need I don't want to use DualSense. I just want to use my Xbox Elite controller everywhere. So we need to fix that. Lena Khan.
Lena, if you're listening, step one.
I need
one.
To be able to use my gaming headsets across every single platform. They need to all be compatible. We need to fix this. We need the online accounts and friends list to transfer back and forth.
Just that crossplay.
The blockchain fixes this. I'm not saying that I'm the last person on Crypto Island now, and now that everyone else is running from it, I'm going to die on this hill alone. But the blockchain does fix this, just saying. So I think those are my concerns.
Historically on the Vergecast, I have assigned Dieter many articles based on throwaway comments. Richard, welcome to your role as filling in for David while he's out on parental leave. You got to write the gamer's Bill of Rights. Like, what should the FTC ask for from a gamer's perspective
Yes.
to make this deal go through?
Get really nuanced about the skins you want to see.
A gamer's demand.
You should never have to pay for a recolor again, ever. If it's not a new, completely new design, then you can't sell it. I should be able to get whatever colors I want. I'm just saying.
This is great. We got to do this. If you have ideas for Richard, you can tweet it in. You can email him. We're going to put this together. We'll send it to the FTC.
Yeah.
I'm never getting an FTC official on Decoder again. Like, it's never going to happen.
I think they'll see this and be like, oh, they get it. They get it. This is why we put it in administrative law court.
Look, I'm saying this is a generationally important antitrust case. Like, if they get this one through, what it will signal is if the FTC wins this, if the FTC wins this and they block this deal, it will signal competition law in the United States is changing. If they lose it, it means either someone promised Lena Khan controller interop, which maybe that's all we need, or it means that, like, we live to fight another day.
Yeah.
Right. And I will say that in this lame duck period of Congress, the big antitrust bills are on the floor. There's a lot of momentum around them, particularly the App Store interoperability bill. Like, there's stuff, the Digital Markets Act, like all this stuff. There's more antitrust noise happening right now than has happened in a while. This lawsuit's a piece of it. The Meta Supernatural case, which again is very small compared to the Activision deal, but it is a signal of where the government wants to apply pressure. And then there are the bills in Congress. So we'll see.
We'll see. And I mean, other things we saw this week, we should probably talk about, kind of related. I'm gonna go all the way back to how we talked about the EU is also suing.
They're just nuts, man. They're just like eating cheese and being like, we got ideas.
We got ideas and you will do them, including Apple. You will have USB-C on your phones. And they set a deadline for that this week.
December 28th, 2024.
Yeah. So by December 28th, 2024, you will have new phones with USB-C for wired charging, so, including iPhones, theoretically.
Can I just say something about this? Okay. Also, right? They're Europeans. They can't help themselves. Like, the EU is so needlessly complicated.
Yeah.
And we have an amazing international team that is mostly based in Europe. You just heard from James. John Porter is our reporter who's been working on this story.
Yeah.
And, like, he has basically written a version of the headline, European Union mandates USB-C for phones 500 times.
And we make him do it again.
And we make him do it again and again. Mostly because it's, like, interesting. We should track the story. We have a responsibility as journalists to accurately convey. And also because it's traffic gold. Like, people see this headline, they lose their minds. Like, how can I click on this twice? And it's like, guys, we've just written this story like every other week for 5 years. So he writes, he's excited. We finally have a final official deadline for when new phones sold in the European Union, including future iPhones, will have to use USB-C in December 20, 2024. The next paragraph. The new rules will officially enter into force in 20 days' time, and individual EU member states will then have a maximum of 24 months to write national laws.
No.
It's like, oh, this still hasn't happened, is it?
We have to make him do one for every single country. Luxembourg. John, we have to know what Luxembourg voted on.
It's like, oh man, this still hasn't happened.
It hasn't happened in Belgium. All right, it's done. It's
like, all right, this is just like fully ridiculous.
He's got like a map in his house.
It's like someone in the EU like runs like a traffic bait website, and they're like, let's stretch it out. Like, we know people love this story.
Just as long
another 24 months of USB-C iPhone clicks.
So good.
It's good. So that's the date.
That's
this implies this sort of 2025 iPhone.
The iPhone 16?
Well,
because it says all new phones have to be using it by 2024. So that's not this year.
So the iPhone that gets announced in 2024
will have to be USB-C.
So right now we're on the 14, which is the iPhone that was announced
2022.
Yeah.
So 15
is 2023.
And then 16 is 2024. So okay. This will be the iPhone 16. Should theoretically be USB-C, unless they decide to be like, you know what, EU, you don't get a phone this year.
That would be amazing.
Just never mind.
We'll see. Importantly, you might recall that the UK is no longer in the European Union. Notably, the United States is not. I don't believe China is in the European Union. All gigantic markets for Apple.
Unclear if China's in the European Union.
Look, I'm not a geologist.
Yeah. Who knows what kind of rocks they got going on over there?
It's been a long one. And also, I think James's drinking beer rubbed off of me. But I would say those are giant markets for Apple. Yeah. They could make Lightning iPhones and USB-C iPhones. We don't know what they're going to do.
Just that one, they released like 500 of them, limited edition in Germany.
And in Brazil, they still have to put the charger in the box.
That's true. I got a real taste of careful what you wish for last week. So I went home for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
You know, did the turn motion smoothing off on all the TVs.
First thing.
Ran around fixing stuff at my parents' house, bought them the new Apple TV remotes.
Yeah.
So they had the old black ones. They were horrible. Whatever.
Did they also have scotch tape on theirs like my mom does?
It's a long story. My parents finally shut down their AT&T U-verse cable boxes.
Wow.
It's a five-year victory. If you've been listening, you know, I've been working on this for 5 years. And they switched to the cable company. Now they're doing all their TV through the Apple TV. Got rid of the cable boxes, consolidated the remotes, buy the new remotes.
Yeah.
Spot new remotes. Just went to Best Buy, pulled three of them off the shelf, came home, set them up, off we go. Little do I know that I bought two of the older Lightning remotes and one of the new USB-C remotes. No. So I get the most bizarre text from my dad, who's like, I'm using the kitchen TV. Is the plug different? And like, just out of context, they're like, what are you talking about? Like, is the plug in the wall?
Did you buy a new TV
like,
from Europe?
Why are you unplugging the TV? Like, just leave it. Let's stop it. So I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, the plugs for the other two rooms work fine, but this one doesn't. And it's like, yeah, you know, it's like, I'm at work. I'm like, different plan. I'm like, you just call me, send me a picture. And he sends me a picture of the bottom room. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, I asked for this. I asked for everything to be USB-C. And now there's one USB-C Apple device in my parents' house.
Just one.
And it is just like the crime of the century.
Did you try to explain to him they could use their phone as a remote? Because it doesn't work.
Absolutely not. I told him that they could plug in this. When I say this is like a galaxy brain moment, I was like, just use the charger from your Chromebook. And they plugged it in their remote. And they're like, will it explode? Because you're just like you're not supposed to do this.
Benson Leung has a lot of evidence that might happen. I'm just saying.
But I was like, oh God, I asked for this.
You did.
I was like, Apple, make it all USB-C. And they're like, one out of three.
That's what's going to happen with the iPhones. You're going to get both of them iPhones, and for some reason, one will be USB-C, and the other will not.
Just dealer's choice.
Dad, you can charge with the Chromebook. Mom, you have to go find the remote.
Yeah. All right, other stuff. Richard, what's going on with Elon this week? I feel like it's we could go the entire show without talking about Elon and Twitter.
Speedrun it. Go.
Not nearly as much as there has been before. Everyone else is trying to build their own Twitter. People who used to work for Twitter. Other tech engineers, Tumblr, of course, Alex is always ready to be the new Twitter.
They're ready.
And so if you're looking for a better Twitter, there are options. I went back to Black Planet. I've had that account for 20 years. I'm never leaving. Meanwhile, at Twitter, Elon still somehow needs to try and make money from the company that he now owns. And his plan is this Twitter Blue subscription that he thinks everyone will pay for to be verified and to make sure that your tweets actually show up so that people can see them. The latest thing that we've heard is that if you purchase this from your iPhone, it might cost more. That it would cost $7 per month if you subscribe on the web, or $11 via the iOS app. No one has mentioned Google Play. I guess doesn't really matter.
Aww.
But you know, getting around the Apple commission that way, and that was the whole battle and back and forth that they had that culminated with Elon going to see Tim Cook and reaching some kind of agreement. So maybe so, this is the outcome of that.
So the public facts of this agreement are now, I think, well known. Mm-hmm. So Apple had pulled back on its advertising spend like most big companies had done.
Right.
Because they didn't know about the trust
and they
and
were the biggest
issue.
Advertiser.
And they were the biggest advertiser. Alex Heath has pointed this out. Apple spends no money on Meta. Just none. So no Instagram, no, which makes sense. They don't like each other.
Yeah.
So where's that money going to go? It has gone to Twitter. So Apple's one of Twitter's biggest accounts. So Apple pulls back their advertising. Elon tweets, "Don't you support free speech in America?" Then there's this weird issue, which we still kind of don't understand, where Apple's like, "You've got to comply with our moderation rules to the App Store, or we're going to pull you." Or they just remind, as they often do, mafia style.
They just sat there with a baseball bat.
They just drove up in front of the store holding a rock. And they're like, "Mow those windows. It would sure be a shame."
Wouldn't want anything to happen to them.
So Elon gets mad. Tim Cook summons Elon. Oh, and Elon gets mad about the 30% tax.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which he's been mad about for a while.
He suddenly discovered. He was like, "Guys, I have brand new information. There's a 30% tax."
But we talked about this last week. A bunch of Republican Congress people get all up in arms. The antitrust bill becomes a threat.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Cook summons Elon
to
the spaceship. We don't know what the deal was.
Yeah.
He leaves. But now it's publicly revealed Apple's ad spending has gone back up. And Elon has agreed to up the price of Twitter Blue on iOS 30%. So it's like, oh, you just – Apple's paying you the money in ads, and then you're going to pay it back to them in App Store fees. That is the deal that the most genius business people of our
they
time
did it.
Have constructed.
Nailed it.
Here's what we're going to do. We're going to start advertising on Twitter again to increase your revenue. And then when you launch your paid product, which you want to be 50% of Twitter's revenue, 30% of that will come right back to the old spaceship.
Yep.
Tim's like, "All right, that you good? I've got to go do some supply chain stuff." And Elon left. Like, that appears to be the deal.
Yeah.
That is all. And that the advertising information is directly from Elon. We will see what the price of Twitter Blue is when it comes out, but all indications are
when it returns.
When it returns, but all indications are it will be priced at 30% above the web price to account for that fee. And as we all know, most things Apple collects that fee because most of the money is made on the phone.
Yeah,
a beautiful circle.
I love it. Like, it's as beautiful a circle as the spaceship itself. I'm sorry.
You did it.
I did it.
The modern economy.
You know what? Let's talk about Apple some more. Let's get away from talking about
Elon. Oh, there's good Apple stuff.
There's good Apple stuff. Yeah. We got so Apple announced a bunch of encryption stuff this week, right? Richard, I think you were watching it like in the weeds on this.
Yes, this was a bit of a surprise, but it is major news. And I'm not sure if everyone, when you see this, if you understand exactly how big this is. But a lot of the people who pay attention to security and privacy on our devices on the internet see this as one of the biggest announcements that they'll hear, I guess, around this time of the year. What Apple has done is they've announced a number of security announcements. And one of the most impactful ones is an optional program that they're calling Advanced Data Protection. And if you opt into it, then it expands the number of data categories, as they call them, that are protected by end-to-end encryption. And they've always talked about how they have end-to-end encryption on a lot of things so that no one can really spy on your data. Even on Apple's end, if the government asks them to give it up, they can't because they don't have access to it. It can only be decrypted on your device.
Right.
But that did not apply to iPhone backups. So while something like iMessage might be encrypted end-to-end, and they kept saying that it is, if you or the person you're messaging has a backup of their iPhone that is then uploaded to the iCloud servers, if, for example, if somehow someone accessed your account or if they got a warrant from the government to access it, they could simply access the unencrypted data very easily.
Right.
And that won't be possible anymore once this rolls out because, you know, your iPhone backups will be one of the categories that are now protected by encryption, which is just a very significant change and one that the FBI, now that this has been announced, has said that they are not happy about. Rather predictably.
Apple famously fought a huge battle with the FBI in 2016.
This is the San Bernardino shootings, right?
Around unlocking the shooter's phone. The FBI has wanted a backdoor into encryption. Apple has famously said no. The most interesting turn of this story, which we need to learn more about, is, was it last year? This year?
The CSAM thing?
The CSAM thing. Apple announced it was last year.
Yeah, late last year, they announced these changes to CSAM where it would, if you were backing up a photo on iCloud Photos, it would then scan the photo while it's still on your device, not on Apple's end, not on the servers, and, you know, kind of create a hash a hash of it and try to match that to known child sexual abuse imagery and alert someone if it finds
out. And everybody was mad about it.
And no, and yeah, privacy, security, everyone was very upset about this because it's kind of it's a slippery slope. Now you're doing scanning on people's personal devices. B, if those hashes, if someone somehow gets something into the database that's like, we're looking for government documents, you know, now suddenly your phone is leaking that information. There are a number of bad outcomes here. And now Apple has said that that program is dead. They're not going to do it.
Yeah. And I think longtime listeners of this show will recall Apple was real shady about all of that when it rolled it out. They rolled it out. It wouldn't tell us who the researchers were. All of its communications were like unsourced.
They're like, just enjoy it. It's going to be great. Just like, shut up.
They were holding these briefings without telling anybody who anybody was talking to.
Yeah.
And they had basically courted all this controversy. And then they said, we're putting it on pause. And the trade-off, I want to be clear, the trade-off that Apple was trying to make on paper was a good trade-off, which is we want to protect your data as much as we can. We want to keep the government and the cops out of our servers. We want to protect your privacy. But we know that bad people do bad things. And the category of bad things that everybody agrees on without a shadow of a doubt is CSAM. So we're going to build in a somehow privacy-respecting feature that scans your phone for this material before it hits our servers. And that way we can encrypt what's on the servers. We can encrypt iCloud.
Yeah.
Because Google, Microsoft, every other cloud service is scanning their data stores for CSAM.
Right.
They're all doing it. Like, and they should. Like, yeah. Everyone agrees that this is a bad thing. Apple's like, we want to go one step farther and encrypt the backup so we can't read it. Because our other choice is to do what everyone else does and scan iCloud.
Yeah.
So they're like, okay, we'll move the scanning to your phone. And again, on paper, this trade-off makes some kind of sense.
Yeah, I think in a vacuum, I think like if you're sitting in a room with a bunch of people who've been working on this problem for years, which I assume was happening at Apple, you say this and you go, yes, awesome, perfect. And then they didn't actually check with anyone else until right before. I think they reached out to the EFF and a couple other folks right before they were going to do it. And they're like, we're going to do this. And they were all like, cool. Yeah. You waited way too late. This is a terrible plan and everything about it is bad because you are still fundamentally creating a backdoor into people's devices and anybody with access to this database can really misappropriate it and use it.
Yeah. And we have episodes of Decoder and the Vergecast like in the controversy of why it was bad. But that was the trade-off, right?
Right.
Everyone assumed that Apple was rolling out the scanning feature so they could get the desired end state of encrypted iCloud.
Yeah.
It's a year later, they've rolled out encrypted iCloud, and they are canceling the phone scanning, which is utterly fascinating to me.
And they also added another thing, which I thought was really interesting, because one of the responses to this was, well, if you create this database that is like managed by the government, then other governments can misuse this database. And one of the things they also announced this week was like they claim that iMessage can possibly alert you if state-sponsored spies are eavesdropping on you. And it's like, okay, so y'all just went hard in the other direction to say, nah, fuck the police.
Good.
Basically.
That's Tim Cook.
Yeah, that's
Tim Cook. When I think of Tim Cook, I think of a man saying, fuck the police.
Yeah, immediately. First thing I think of. But that was like kind of surprising to me that they went that hard in the other direction. And I keep thinking about like, a lot of these conversations we had last year about this was about China and specifically how China could potentially use this database. And now, like, we know.
So Joanna Stern at the Wall Street Journal, notable Verge expat, Joanna Stern.
Lovely.
Our mole at the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah. Here's the deets.
At the Journal, they're always detecting that they have a leaker. The Verge has infiltrated us once again. But Joanna Stern got the big exclusive with Craig Federighi. You should go watch her video with him. She asked him a question about China and our man just deferred.
Yeah.
Did not answer the question about whether iCloud backups in China would be encrypted. In China, the government, the Chinese government, effectively controls the iCloud data centers.
Yes.
So Apple always kind of making its concessions for the – I've been told China is not in the EU. always making concessions for its large market. Obviously, there's a lot going on in China recently. We've not talked about it on the show very much. There are large-scale protests about COVID lockdowns. there are protests at the Foxconn factories where Apple makes the phones, or Apple production slowdowns for its phones.
Yep.
Just quite a lot going on in
China. And you've also seen Apple make some really deliberate attempts to move away from China, particularly in manufacturing. They've asked Foxconn, they've asked these other manufacturers they work with to move, to get out of there, to like go to India, to go to, I think,
Arizona.
Yes, speaking of. And they're asking them to move to these other places. And I'm going to use that as a segue to talk about Arizona. Thank you, Richard. Laid that up for me. Because the other big news this week from Apple was that they're going to start making chips for iPhones in Arizona, these new fabs that TSMC just opened.
Yeah, so TSMC, I want to give TSMC credit here.
Yes.
Is the person who was dunked on Foxconn lying to the people of Wisconsin the most.
They did not build a big globe. 4 years.
They did not. TSMC took a bunch of tax subsidies, lobbied their way into the CHIPS Act, which is going into effect, and they have actually built fabs in Arizona. The fabs are going to start producing chips in 2024. Mm-hmm. The ceremony that we saw with AMD, NVIDIA, Tim Cook, Biden, they're all there, was the installation of fab equipment. It was not golden shovels.
I love it.
Amazing. And they're going to add a second site in 2026. Liam looks so happy. So just congrats to TSMC for doing a thing they said they were going to do.
Yeah.
And they're going to do it. And so Tim Cook has promised that the chips, they're going to make M series and A series chips there. AMD and NVIDIA are going to build chips there. It's like a 3-nanometer node.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the stuff that's really hard to make. You know, Intel's trying to get their own fabs online so that they can jump into this space. But TSMC kind of owns the market on these really small nodes. And so this is big news because we haven't had a node this small built in the United States in a while. It's primarily been built in Taiwan. And I'm going to be really like, it should create jobs, theoretically. It should make that, like, the CHIPS Act make more sense. And suddenly you're, instead of like having to, like, Intel will have a new resources for hiring, right?
Yeah.
If this TSMC fab goes online.
It's cool news. We sent a reporter named Andy Bly down to cover it, took photos, the whole thing. Go read that report. They actually did it.
Yeah, they did.
Now, is it as fun to cover as an empty dome and lies? Less so.
We'll
more
see.
More important to the global economy.
From a content perspective, it was pretty much a failure. I think we
I'm
can
like,
say
where's
that.
Your dome, bro?
Yeah. Failure of content, but, you know.
Before we get off of Apple, I do want to mention they made other security announcements. Like, you'll be able to use hardware keys to secure your iCloud account. You'll be able to do this kind of key verification, which you're referencing, Alex, that will enable that, or potentially enable that ability to see if someone's trying to spy on your a conversation that makes it a lot more like Signal or like using PGP and email or something like that. So there are also other important security announcements that they made that are there. And they also made a very strange change. They're going to roll out globally this change that rolled out in China during the protests, where when you turn on AirDrop, I think to receive files, you'll only be able to do it for 10 minutes, which makes it a little bit harder to use this strategy that people have been using to distribute, you know, information that the government doesn't want it to get passed around.
I just share gritty photos.
Oh my God. That's it. We're already over.
We got to cut to break. We got to.
Liam's losing his mind back here. Don't be nice to Liam.
Everyone be nice
There's
to
no
Liam.
There's no clock this time. There's just a sense of shame that pervades this room because we are at 90 minutes already and we have another segment.
We're having a great time.
We're going to be right back. We got a gadget lightning round. We'll be right back.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him. The sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money where he earns 5% annual percentage yield. So he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
All right, we're back. This is going to be a lightning gadget.
Lightning of lightning rounds. It's lightning. All right. There wasn't a lot of gadgets this week.
Go for it.
Okay. So first up, this is my favorite thing ever released in the history of the world. Huawei's latest smartwatch.
This is so dumb.
Has earbuds in it. So you can be like, oh, I got to listen to this call. And just go boop and flip the top
is
of
this
your smartwatch.
This is just a digital watch. It's not a smartwatch. This is a black and white segment LCD display.
You know, it's got weather. It's got heart rate. I'm calling it smart. It's smart.
Oh, no. That's just a face.
And what is smarter than having built-in earbuds, wireless earbuds that you can just pop out, stick in your ear? They announced it on Weibo, which is a Chinese network, and they're called the Huawei Watch Buds. They've already launched, just not in America.
Wait. Okay. First of all, Watch Buds is an incredible name. Second, why would they demo this with this face that's like a 1982 Casio segmented?
Because it's sick.
I will admit they got me.
Because they know that I'm the person.
Richard, have you already imported
and
it?
And directly made me. They were like, yes. They knew who
right,
they were.
Can we talk about the most important gadget of the week, which is the $950 Dyson combo platter headphones and air purifier like mask?
Liam and I immediately looked. V Song was in the office today, and we looked to her and we're like, "You're getting it right." She's like, "I'm gonna try. I want nothing to be reviewed more."
Okay, my favorite kinds of companies in the world are companies that have like one piece of technology, and they're like, "What can we do with it?"
Dyson's like wind.
Yeah, Dyson's like, "Here's what we did. We made a fan.
Sick ass fan.
The fan can both suck and blow." And for like 10 years, they're like, "We're deeply focused on suck." Yeah. Like, what have you guys seen our vacuums? That's just a fan going this way. And then kind of like recently.
The fan went the other way.
They're like, switch that motherfucker to blow.
And reverse, baby.
And they're like, here's the fan. Here's the hairdryer.
I used it today before the show. It's great.
It's incredible that they're like, here's what we do, fans. They, for a minute, they're like, we're going to do cars. And then I think they realized, like,
cars don't run on fans.
They're like, well, it's not a climate control fan. Does anyone know how to do any other part of the car?
They should start doing the hover.
They should do the hovercraft. And now they're like, all right, what can we put a fan into? And they're like, headphones. And someone, like, it has to be. There was a meeting where they're like, what else can we put fans into? The car didn't work. We need an idea.
And you know what's really sad? Party speakers were right there.
They're right coming. There. And someone was like, I got it. Headphones. And there was a blank stare in the room. And they're like, you just wait and see.
But with a mask on the front.
And it's, I mean, you just have to see it. I'm buying these so much.
You're going to spend $949.
The best problem of them is that they're vaporware.
Yes.
Sorry. The best part of them is that they're vaporware.
It says you'll be able to pre-order.
You can only, they were announced like a year ago.
But you can start pre-ordering
and you can
next
pre-order
year.
Them.
Not even there. No, next year. I think they've got a shot.
They're great. This is the only gadget worth buying. I'm just excited to see what else Dyson can put a fan into. I mean, the fact they were like, we're going to do cars. And then they're like, not enough fans.
Not enough fans.
Our plan for a wind powered car.
Like air conditioners? Have you considered the air conditioner? No. No. They're like headphones?
Yeah, headphones.
This is it. What about shoes?
Shoes. Very good. What else you got?
All right. What else do we got? I believe Allison did a review of the Amazon Echo Auto. I refuse to say it the other way. She wasn't a fan.
This thing still makes no sense to me. I don't know why you would want an Echo Auto.
One of the bad things was Alexa isn't very helpful in a car. Because, yeah, Alexa isn't very helpful in a car. There's no smart lights in a car to control. You can just hit a button to play music.
Well, so I think what they know is that people have a lot of ideas in cars while they're driving around. Right, like, again, on paper, imagine the meeting.
Yeah.
Like, what do people want to do in the car? They want to play music. What is the number one use of Alexa? People ask for music.
Yes.
I don't know how many timers people set in their cars. This is number two.
Every time I'm trying to, like, make that get the miles. Yeah. Right, you know? I'm like, all right, set a timer.
Set a timer for 5 minutes.
Then gun it.
All right, fair. We're all different.
Never done that.
You should start.
I'm going to.
So, like, okay, people want to ask for music. We can add the thing for music. And then maybe when they're driving around, they'll be like, you should buy some paper towels. Oh, I forgot to buy paper towels. Alexa, buy some paper. Like, you can see the thought process.
Yeah. And then they remember that nobody actually will ever do that.
It's a real problem.
It's a real, like... It's just bad. I love, like, all of her problems with it, where it's like, yeah, Alexa's just stupid to have in a car.
They got to add ChatGPT to it.
Yeah.
Or a fan.
It's also like that weird Spotify thing in that you still pretty much need your phone, but you can just do this stuff with your phone.
But the Spotify one, you can at least, like, connect to your computer and make a new controller.
It had a knob. It had a knob.
Yeah. Had the knob. Put a knob on this. I bet it would have gone up to a 7. Allison would have loved it.
Anything then. With a giant rotary knob always wins for us.
Anything.
Okay, what are these watches? The Coros Apex 2?
Yeah, so V reviewed some new multi-sport watches. She liked them. They didn't have a knob on them, but she still gave them a 7. They're pretty expensive, but I think the big thing here is that really good battery life. They're really for runners. They're really for people who are like... They go outdoors. I'm not familiar with these kinds of people, so I can't say if this is a good purchase for people. But Victoria does, in fact, go outside on a regular basis, and she seemed to like them.
Okay, we got to talk about the Symphonisk floor lamp.
Symphonisk.
It's amazing that they just added legs to it and changed the shade.
What if it was taller?
I'm so ready to get these.
Yeah.
And just be like, everywhere in my home, there are tiny lamp speakers. And I don't know why. I don't know why I feel this way.
Because you want your home to be like one of those really fancy rich people's homes where you're like, where's that music coming from? Or like when you go to the Apple
it's
campus.
These lamps.
And you're like, where is that? Is that music coming from a rock? Now it's your lamps.
So it's $260. The standard lamp speaker is $179. So it's an $80 premium for some legs.
So you could just put it on something tall.
Yes. This is a choice that you have.
Okay.
I am very excited about just the idea. I think the CES is going to be... Richard and I used to cover, like, we were in the weeds
tall,
of
smart
CES
speakers,
together
speakers.
In Engadget, like, back in the day.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I remember, like, when Pioneer and Panasonic would, like, demo plasma TVs to us. Like, that's how Richard and I came up. Like, I remember the HD DVD Blu-ray format war that Richard and I covered together.
Aww.
And so,
when we were on, I was on the plane on the way to CES when they announced that it was over. I'm not over.
We were like geared up to, like, this is the year of the format war. And they're like, HDDVD is dead. They had to tear down the booth at CES. It's a real thing that happened, like, in the dead of night.
While you all were there?
Yeah, it was going to be the year of the format war
and
between HDDVD and Blu-ray.
And Toshiba said, no, we're done.
And then Toshiba just
they
gave
were just
up.
Like, they got there, they looked around, they're like, what if we just, like, hung out in Vegas and they tore the booths down?
Same. Honestly, same. I do not judge you one bit.
Since then, there has not been a lot of drama at CS, I would say. But CS is always a TV show.
Yep.
I would say this is the year where I'm expecting to see, like, some interesting TVs and a lot of, like, really wild Atmos, like, home theater ideas. It's coming.
I would like that.
And these, like, Sonos wireless rears as lamps is, like, it's just the beginning. It's just the
it's not
drop.
Sonos. It works with Sonos, but it's IKEA lamps.
Yeah, yeah. They're out ahead of the flood.
Yeah.
Like, this is...
Well, I think what we're going to see is we've got these engineers who we obviously had the pandemic and everybody suddenly was stuck at home. You have these engineers who are at their house all the time. The stuff that they built is finally coming. It's going to get strange. Just roll with
it. And not a single one of them knows what a good lamp looks like.
And I'm just saying, this is like they're out ahead of the CS rush. They announced some stuff. You can't buy it now. It's not until January. So this isn't like stocking stuff or stuff.
Yeah.
Although the idea of a speaker lamp in your stocking is incredible. Just,
what's that giant 8-foot tall box in
Merry
my
Christmas?
What could it be?
So they're just out ahead of the flood.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, this is the first drop of CES. Crazy. It's coming.
It's the speakers. The year of the speakers in ChatGPT.
Richard, do you know anything about this DJI Mini 3 drone? I'm in the market for another drone that I'll never use, and this feels like it.
That's the only thing I think about is buying drones that I never actually fly, because I bought a DJI. I don't even remember what the name of it is. I have a Phantom.
Oh, my God. You have, like a Phantom 3 or a Phantom 4?
Yes.
You're a maniac.
Three, I think.
I bought a Phantom 4 that I never flew. I sold it when I had a kid. I was like, I got to get ready for this baby. And Becky's like, I've redone the house. And I was like, I sold the drone.
That's the Verge equivalent of I got rid of the motorcycle.
Exactly.
For you. These fingers are safe now. I can pick up our child.
She's like, great. Are you going to help? She's like, I am
and
making
now they have
the child.
A new drone that you can buy and never actually fly anywhere.
Well, this is an expensive drone, though. $859.
Yeah, but it's kind of the remote has a screen. It's a
okay,
little
that's
guy.
Cool.
I have the original Mini, which is like just not quite good enough.
Yeah.
I'm so shocked that DJI is still selling stuff in the United States. Like, remember, they were on the Euro Chinese company hit list for the long time. For the
yes,
time.
Because this is DJI is a Chinese company, but they're also the only company that makes like good drones.
I'm just saying, they're a Chinese company whose product is flying cameras. Like, of all the companies, we're like, huh, this seems like a problem.
And the American government went, yeah, but I want to fly my drones.
Yeah, they're like, yes, but Hollywood needs these. Have you seen car commercials? What are we going to do?
Like, helicopters? Absolutely not.
Stable Diffusion. We got to wrap this up. We're so far over.
I mean, wait. Important news. Somebody just let me know that the Amazon Kindle Scribe is getting a software update. So you will no longer just have to email files to yourself when you want to put them on the Scribe.
What can you do instead?
You can use an app.
Cool.
I know everybody was really concerned about this. I got a lot of emails. So that's for you guys.
All right, a little scoop on the Vergecast for the Kindle Scribe community.
All four
excited
of you.
For the Scribe blog. You know, back in the day, like there would have been a dedicated gadget blog for the Kindle Scribe.
Yes, 100%. All the things you can do.
Bring it back. All right, that's it. Thanks to James Vincent for joining us. Thanks to Richard for joining us. With David out on baby leave, I wonder if he had to sell his drone to have a baby. That's really not how that connection works, but that's how I'm going to start thinking about it. You're going to be hearing a lot from Richard. It's going to be a lot of fun. That's it. By the way, a bunch of cool stuff on the site this week. Liz has a big piece about FTX. Not what you would expect, though.
Mm-hmm.
The FTX story is broken by a really actually great crypto news outlet called CoinDesk. CoinDesk is owned by a crypto exchange.
Oof.
So they might have just like knifed themselves. Great story about the politics of tech and journalism and crypto. I mean, it's like a perfect.
It was wonderful.
But for the FTX story, if you believe what the government might be accusing SBF of, shooting yourself in the foot is kind of on brand. We'll see what happens.
We'll
see how that
goes. It's very good. There's actually a great week on the site. Go check it all out. We'll be back on Wednesday. We did, Alex and I talked to Charles Pulliam Moore about winners and losers in streaming. So we basically did the go 90 scale.
Yeah.
We thought we were going to go 30 minutes. We went 90, which is perfect. Makes sense.
It was beautiful. It was great.
So we'll hear you. We'll see you on Wednesday. You can tweet at us. Alex is Alex H. Kranz. Richard is at RJCC. James is at JJ Vincent. I'm at Reckless. We love hearing from you for as long as Twitter's going to last. Tweet at us. We love it. That's it. That's Vergecast. Rock and roll.
And that's a wrap for Vergecast this week. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, subscribe in the podcast app of your choice or tell a friend. You can send us feedback at vergecast@theverge.com. This show is produced by me, Liam James, and our senior audio director, Andrew Marino. This episode was edited and mixed by Amanda Rose Smith. Our editorial director is Brooke Minters, and our executive producer is Eleanor Donovan. The Vergecast is a production of The Verge and Vox Media Podcast Network. And that's it. We'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright. exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari, W, and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.